content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is from the 13 Things column, Fast Facts About NASCAR by Eric Raskin. Number one, drivers, start your engines. The annual NASCAR Cup Series kicks off February 15 with the Daytona 500 at Daytona International Speedway in Florida. Considered NASCAR's most prestigious event, the Daytona 500 is often called the Great American Race. First place will pocket an estimated $3 million. Number two, to win the Cup Series, a driver must top the standings at the end of the 36-race season. What determines those standings are points, which drivers earn for their position at each stage of each race. Drivers race more than 12,000 miles in total each season. The numbers in race names indicate the miles, not the laps. That's like going from New York to Los Angeles and back twice. 3. The National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, NASCAR for short, was founded in 1947, but its roots trace back to Prohibition. Bootleggers of the 1920s and 30s moved alcohol in cars modified for extra speed so nimble drivers could outrun the police. The winner of the first official NASCAR race, held in Daytona in February 1948, was the former booze runner Robert Red Byron. Number four. If auto racing hardly seems like a sport to you, consider this. During a race, a driver's heart rate turbos to 170 to 180 beats per minute, right in line with the average marathoner. NASCAR drivers also lose up to 7 pounds of sweat from start to finish, so they use pit stops to wolf down energy gels and bars. Number five. Pit stops last an average of 13 to 16 seconds. In that blink of an eye, five people from the pit crew refuel the car and change some or all of the tires. The fastest tire changers make a swap in about 4 seconds. Number six. Racetracks vary in size, ranging from the shortest, the quarter-mile oval at Bowman Gray Stadium in North Carolina, to the longest, Road America in Wisconsin, a 4-mile road course with 14 turns. Not every track features in the Cup Series every year, except stalwarts like Daytona and Indiana's Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But the Indy 500 race that also happens at the Speedway is not a NASCAR event. It's part of the IndyCar Series, which is more like Formula One. Number seven. Formula One, or F1, features smaller, single-seat cars with open cockpits. These cars go faster than the stock cars of NASCAR, which look more like sedans. Some F1 races take place on city streets, not racetracks. In the United States, NASCAR is the more popular of the two. Globally, F1 has the larger fan base. But F1 has exploded in popularity stateside, thanks in part to the Netflix reality series Formula One Drive to Survive. ESPN, which broadcast F1 races, says viewership has doubled since 2018. Number eight. Still, NASCAR is not an exclusively American sport. Races have been held as far away as Australia and Japan, and last June, an official point-paying Cup Series race was held outside the U.S. for the first time, at the Autódromo Hermanos Rodríguez in Mexico City. NASCAR also runs separate series in Mexico, Canada, and Brazil, as well as one in Europe. Number nine. Women make up about 37% of the NASCAR fan base. In fact, female drivers go bumper to bumper with their male counterparts in NASCAR races. Danica Patrick is perhaps the most famous female driver. She became the first woman to hold the pole position, the front and most favorable position at the start of a race, given to the driver with the fastest qualifying time, in the Daytona 500 in 2013. Though Patrick never won a NASCAR race before she retired in 2018, she still holds the record for the most top 10 finishes by a female driver at 7. Number 10. When three drivers cross the finish line just 0.007th of a second apart at a race in Atlanta in February 2024, two high-speed cameras determined their order. Of course, such technology didn't exist at the first Daytona 500 in 1959. Lee Petty was declared the winner of that race, but not until 61 hours after it ended. A newsreel image developed days after the race proved that Petty had crossed the finish line 2 feet ahead of his competitor, Johnny Beauchamp. Number 11. Lee Petty's son, Richard Petty, is a NASCAR legend in his own right. Affectionately known as the King among fans, Richard is the all-time winningest driver with 200 wins, nearly twice as many victories as David Pearson, who holds second place. On the opposite end of things, J.D. McDuffie raced 653 times in his nearly 30-year career beginning in 1963, yet he never won a race. Number 12. Even if you've never watched NASCAR, you'd likely still recognize the black and white checkered flag that signals the end of a race. The flagman, who stands above the finish line and essentially controls the race, uses different flags to communicate various messages to the drivers, including white, one lap remaining, green, go, race normally, yellow, reduce speed, race under caution, and red, stop. Yellow and red flags may also be used to indicate dangerous conditions like bad weather, debris on the track, or crashes. And finally, number 13, auto racing, it must be said, is inherently dangerous. Cars collide regularly, often going 200 miles per hour. Following the 2001 death of driver Dale Earnhardt Sr. from a crash during the final lap of the Daytona 500, NASCAR implemented safety upgrades, such as the Hans device, a head restraint designed to protect the neck, and the Safer Barrier, a cushioned wall that surrounds the track. Thankfully, there have been no driver fatalities in the NASCAR Cup Series since. For our next piece, let's do the Word Power Vocabulary Quiz. Adverbs pack a punch. They modify verbs, adjectives, other adverbs, and even whole sentences. These grammatical workhorses explain a lot. When? Where? In what way? For each of the words that I'm going to read below, listen closely and select your answer from three choices decisively. Then, when we're done with that, I will turn to the answers and read those for you. And this is by Sarah Chassay. Number one, cogently, C-O-G-E-N-T-L-Y, an adverb. Is that meaning A, cautiously, B, collectively, or C, convincingly? Number two, gratis, G-R-A-T-I-S. Does that mean A, free of charge, B, in appreciation of, or C, with cheese? Number three, discreetly, D-I-S-C-R-E-T-L-Y. E-E-T-L-Y. Does it mean A, piece by piece, B, avoiding notice, or C, at once? Number four, alfresco, A-L-F-R-E-S-C-O. Does it mean A, freehand, B, altogether, or C, outdoors? Number five, ostensibly, OSTENSIBLY. Does that mean A, supposedly, B, falsely, or C, awkwardly? Number 6. Plumb. PLUMB. Does it mean A, on both sides, B, underfoot, or C, in a vertical line? Number 7. Askance. ASKANCE. Does that mean A, in a hurry, B, with distrust, or C, upside down? Number 8. Blithely. BLITHELY. Does it mean A, cheerfully, B, inhumanely, or C, mistakenly? Number 9. In situ. Does it mean A, at first glance, B, by the book, or C, in the original position? Number 10. Pell-mell. PELL-MELL. Does it mean so-so, B, wildly, or C, neatly? Number 11. Eminently. EMINENTLY. Does it mean A, highly, B, shortly, or C, widely? Number 12. Asunder. ASUNDER. Does it mean A, underground, B, second, or C, apart? Number 13. Hitherto. HITHERTO. Does it mean A, therefore, B, until now, or C, farther? Number 14. Duly. DULY. Does it mean A, doubly, B, appropriately, or C, plainly? And last, 15. Prolifically. PROLIFICALLY. Does it mean A, wastefully, B, handsomely, or C, plentifully? Truly, madly, deeply. A lot of great writers hate adverbs, especially ones ending in L-Y. The road to hell is paved with adverbs, Stephen King once said. Mark Twain, Toni Morrison, and Elmore Leonard also weren't fans. Although too many adverbs clutter prose, they can be effective, as the famously terse Ernest Hemingway shows in The Sun Also Rises. How did you go bankrupt? Bill asked. Two ways, Mike said. Gradually, and then suddenly. All right, now for the answers. Number 1, cogently. The answer was C, convincingly. Students in debate club learn to argue cogently and respectfully. Number 2, gratis. The answer was A, free of charge. When you dine here on your birthday, we offer dessert gratis, the maitre d' said. Number 3, discreetly. The answer was B, avoiding notice. As the meeting dragged on, Siobhan discreetly checked her watch. Number 4, al fresco. The answer was C, outdoors. What a beautiful day. Shall we dine al fresco? 5, ostensibly. The answer was A, supposedly. Though the book is ostensibly fiction, it mirrors the author's life. Number 6, plumb. The answer was C, in a vertical line. Norm set each fence post plumb in the wet concrete. Number 7, askance. The answer was B, with distrust. The villagers look askance at outsiders. Number 8, blithely. The answer was A, cheerfully. Tatum blithely ignored the rain as she began her hike. Number 9, in situ. That answer was C, in the original position. fossils preserved in situ offer insight into how the animals died. Number 10, pell-mell. The answer was B, wildly. My dogs jump around pell-mell when they hear the word treat. Number 11, eminently. The answer was A, highly. The eminently quotable Yogi Berra once said, "You can observe a lot by watching." Number 12, asunder. The answer was C, apart. The tornado tore the old oak tree asunder. Number 13, hitherto. The answer was B, until now. The biologist was thrilled to have found a hitherto unknown slug species, not least because she then got to name it. Number 14, duly. The answer was B, appropriately. Your objection has been duly noted, counselor, Judge Cruz barked. And finally, number 15, prolifically. The answer was C, plentifully. Carly posts prolifically on Instagram, sharing every detail of her life. So, how did you do? Here are the vocabulary ratings. If you answered 9 or fewer correctly, that would be rated as passably. If you got 10 to 12 of them correct, the rating for that would be amply. And if you scored 13 to 15 of them correctly, the rating would be splendidly. And now from the Reader's Digest sports column, Bigger Than the Game, a couple of excerpts from that article. In sports, some wins mean more than the final score. A boy's big decision. It was a dream come true, but the young baseball fan had another idea, by Bill Hangley Jr. Donna Morey and Jameson Pennings both had a feeling this would be a special day at the ballpark. They both got what they wanted, plus a whole lot more. "He renewed my faith in humanity," Morey says. "It felt really, really good," says Jameson. Jameson was there to achieve a major goal in his 9-year-old life, getting a foul ball at a baseball game. Morey was there to celebrate her 80th birthday with her family. In the end, Jameson got not one, but 2 balls, and Morey got a birthday present she'd never expected, a foul ball from Jameson, a young man she'd never met before. "For the first time in a long time, I was at a loss for words," she says. It all happened one day last September at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia, where the Phillies were squaring off against the New York Mets. Morey and Jameson were both sitting close to the field, a few rows from each other, right by the spot where the ball girls often toss foul balls into the crowd. Jameson was there with his father, James Pennings. The family had splurged on pricey seats just so Jameson could have a shot at snagging a ball. He had his mitt and his Phillies jersey. He was ready. On a scale of 1 to 10, how badly did he want that ball? "Really badly," he says. 9.5. Meanwhile, Morey's family sat with her a few rows away, hoping that their mom could get a ball too. "My daughters take me to a Phillies game every year, but this time was special because it was my 80th birthday," Morey says. "They went all out and got my name and age up on the scoreboard, which I wanted to kill them for." In the 5th inning, Jameson's dream came true. A Mets player rolled a stray ball to the ball girl, and she handed it past the net to Jameson. Success! For a few innings, he sat cradling the ball in his mitt. But then, in the 7th inning, he heard something he couldn't ignore. Morey's daughter, Joan, had come up to the ball girl and made a special request. She said, "Can I get a ball for my mom? It's her 80th birthday," Jameson recalls. The wheels began turning in the young man's head. He's got grandparents. He knows that somebody who's 80 might not get that many more chances to get a ball. "Since he was little, he's had that heart of gold," says his mother, Eve Torres Pennings. "He's always been conscious of how we can include people, make sure they're not left out." So Jameson told himself, "If she doesn't get the next ball, I'll give her mine. By now, the game was almost over, and still no ball for Morey. Jameson knew that his moment had come. I put my head down for a few seconds. It felt like a while, but my dad said it was just a few seconds, says Jameson. I was just phasing between I have to and never mind. It just swept through me. Silently, he made his decision. Then Jameson turned to his father. I want to give that lady my ball, he says. James was shocked. Are you sure? Jameson said he was. So, together, they got up, and Jameson led the way to Morey's seat. What Morey remembers is watching a batter, then feeling her daughter tap her on the arm and hearing her say, This little boy wants to give you something. Morey looked up and saw Jameson. He's got the cutest expression on his face, just kindness, she recalls. He says, I want to give you my foul ball. She was deeply moved. She's got 4 kids and 9 grandchildren. She knows what a baseball means to a 9-year-old. So she thanked him and his father while her family cheered. The Phillies ball girl saw it all, and she made sure Jameson got another ball. Today, Morey's ball sits by the pictures of her grandkids, reminding her every day of Jameson's simple act of kindness. And at the Jameson's house, the second ball sits in his room, signed by Morey and her daughter, reminding him that he made the right decision. Jameson is certain that he did. It's just destiny for her to get a ball, he says. She's been coming to Gaines for 50 years. And lastly, Tagging In, A Wrestling Coach Helps a Team Member's Dad Win at Life, by Shannon Scovel. Sam Latona, a 2-time NCAA All-American wrestler for the Virginia Tech Hokies, remembers getting the call from his family with news that his father was sick. It was January 2022, and the team was traveling back to their campus in Blacksburg, Virginia, after a meet. His dad, Norm Latona, was in kidney failure. Norm's treatment started with in-home dialysis, where a tube was inserted in his belly to flush it and function as his kidney. It worked for about a year, but then his condition declined. He was diagnosed with pneumonia, and that, Sam says, was one of the scariest moments for the family. Sam's brother, Dom Latona, had also wrestled at Virginia Tech. Now Dom was in medical school, and he was able to help explain the intricacies of the situation to Sam. I remember having conversations with my mom and my brothers, just like, what do we have to do? And kind of crying to each other, says Sam. But at the end of the day, we had each other's backs, and we were there for each other. Norm, who lives in Alabaster, Alabama, had to go into a dialysis clinic several times a week for hours at a time to clean out his kidneys. Still, the proud dad kept traveling to watch Sam, finding treatment centers in each city. He spent as much time as he could in Blacksburg, too, for Sam's home meets. I didn't want to miss anything, Norm says. I would come on a Thursday to Blacksburg so I could do a treatment Friday morning. And then he'd watch his son wrestle on Friday night. Blacksburg is not a bad place to spend a couple of days every other week, he says. The head wrestling coach of the Hokies, Tony Robbie, had been following Norm's condition. As Norm struggled and ultimately needed a kidney transplant, Robbie felt called to help. And so, last May, the Hokies announced that Norm had undergone a kidney transplant following prolonged health troubles. The donor? The wrestling coach, Tony Robbie. Fortunately for Norm, the transplant marked the end of a tumultuous and emotional 3-year journey. With the help of the selfless act from Robbie, Norm is now healthy again. Sam describes it as pretty incredible, very surreal medical miracle. Norm had become a good friend over the last several years, so that played a huge role in this, said Robbie. My relationship with him and the kind of person that he is made this an easy decision. Robbie said he had a feeling that he was going to be a match to donate a kidney to Norm. This was all part of God's plan and what he wanted me to do. I just had faith in that, said Robbie. After blood work and a series of rigorous medical tests, it was confirmed Robbie was indeed a match. Sam describes Robbie as not a very emotional guy, but says Robbie gave him a hug and told him how much he loved him as they talked through the decision last January. Months passed. The anticipation of the surgery was on everyone's mind, but Robbie told Sam to focus on wrestling. It was like, I don't want this to change anything about the way that you compete. I don't want you to think anything of it. I just want you to continue to wrestle the way that you are and continue to do the support that you love, Sam says. Sam kept winning until the NCAA Nationals in Philadelphia last March, where he lost in the first round. In early May, he and Robbie went together to Alabama for the operation. On the big day, everyone headed to the hospital around 5 a.m. First came Robbie's procedure to remove one of his kidneys for the transplant. Hours passed. The families, especially his wife, Jennifer Robbie, started to get anxious. By 10 a.m., the doctors came out to update her. They called her over and said finally, "Hey, we got the kidney out. It's going into Mr. Latono," Sam says. 15 minutes later, Tony Robbie's kidney was in Norm Latona's body, supporting his medical needs. The success still wows Sam. It's almost crazy from a medical standpoint. You're like, how is this even possible? Someone else's kidney is in my dad, he says. Their journey in Blacksburg isn't over either. Sam is now recruiting coordinator for the Hokies, representing the team where he competed, and also working with the man who helped save his father's life. Says a grateful Sam, Coach Robbie deserves all the credit for the person that he is and the things that he's done. He's an incredible human being and an awesome person. And those two pieces were for the sports column, Bigger Than the Game. We have run out of time for this program today of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.